And I'm talking to Father John Madden. How many years, John, are you in the college here?
Too many. I came here in 1958, and apart from 2 years, I've been here since. I spent a year in Rome in 81, 82, and then I was in Moat for 1 year in 82, 83, and then I came back here. So I've been teaching up to 1990, and then from there on in, I was assistant bursar for about 10 years.
Right, but very much out here in the college since 1958.
Yeah, 58, yeah. I also did the HDIP in 53, 54, so I spent a year here then too.
Oh, did you?
Oh,
indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
Where were you born and brought up?
Dublin, the other side of the city, Phibsborough.
In Phibsborough?
Yeah.
And where did you go? Did you go to primary
school? I went to St. Vincent's, Glasnevin.
And what did your father do for a living?
We had a grocer shop up in Manor Place.
In Manor Place.
In Manor, yes. Place, yes.
And was the business? It was a family-run business.
It was a small grocery shop, but it was a real country huckster's place. And that would sell, he sold.
Yeah.
You know, it was a grocer basically, but he'd make ice pops when ice pops were new on the market and so on like this.
Yeah, and so it was a different Dublin in those days growing up.
Of course it was a different Dublin. I know there's a lot of improvements in people's lives, but the one thing that you suffer from is security nowadays. In those days, I remember going up there, and we'd go up in the Phoenix Park and get lost in the Furry Glen for hours at a time, and nobody worried about us, you know. We couldn't do that now.
And were you taught by the Christian Brothers? Or
yes,
indeed.
Yes.
About your education, were you? Were those happy days for you?
They were indifferent kind of days. You know what I mean? When you look back on them, there were a couple of very good brothers there at the time in the school, but they didn't play much. And for some reason or other, now, for a Christian Brothers school, they did. I only remember them playing two Gaelic matches in my time there.
And so sport wasn't a thing.
Sport wasn't a thing, except you had a sports day, all right, at the end of the year. They had a big field out at the back end where they did it up for sports day, all right. But it wasn't, there was very little any kind of football. Although there was a definite Gaelic, what would you call it? The brothers were very much Gaelic, but at the same time, nobody seemed to be taking any teams or anything like that at the time, you know, in my time there.
Did you play yourself?
Not for the school, no.
Yeah. And so when you moved out of St. Vincent's,
I went to the novitiate in Kinsale.
In Kinsale?
In Kinsale. That's where the novitiate was in those years, in Cork.
And you were quite a young man, of course, when you...
I was 17 when I went to Kinsale. I went there in 1949. And I was professed in 1950. And I was ordained in 1957.
And you had... Why did you choose to pick the Carmelites as an order?
A strange... Basically... In those days, priests used to come around from the different orders into the school and advertise themselves. And actually, I had no interest very much in that. I always intended being a priest, but I served Mass in the Vincentian Church in Phibsborough, and I intended being a Vincentian. And then I read The Life of the Little Flower, her own life as written by herself, and I got interested in the Carmelites as a result. And I looked up some of the literature that we'd got, and sure enough, there was a Carmelite among them, so I got in contact with them at that stage.
And you were also interested in teaching at the time?
Well, I was very interested in teaching. I came across here to do the higher diploma, And I decided that one thing I wanted to do was teach mathematics. I was always, this was my, at school, I wasn't a great student. I was clever enough, but I wasn't a great student. I basically was only interested in one thing, mathematics, and I kept out of trouble and everything else. In those days, there were no points or anything like that, so I just kept out of trouble. You used to get huge marks in mathematics. Keep out of trouble, a couple of honours or something and other things, you know, and as time went on. So when I came in, I did a degree then at university, and it was a science degree, and it couldn't be more mathematical. It was mathematics. The three subjects that I did for my degree were mathematics, mathematical physics, and physics. Mm-hmm. I was never terribly interested in physics. I had to do it.
It was part of the course.
It was part of it. If you wanted to do the mathematics, you had to.
And your appointment here then in turn, your college?
I was in those years, we used to do 3 years theology, get ordained after 3 years in theology. And then we had a fourth year, which we still stayed in the student house. So we didn't come over here till a year after we had been ordained, basically.
And did you start teaching then?
Well, as soon as I came,
straight away?
Straight away I came. When I came here, I was teaching from there on in.
Yeah.
And because I was interested and because I was good at it, they kept me here.
Well, you were near home as well. That must have been a...
That is, but you didn't, in those days, you know, as students, we got into the habit of not going home that often because we were only let out on feast days and things like that. Big days when there were certain days there were free days, but for an awful lot of the time, you weren't let out. You could go out for walks with one another, but you didn't go home very often. I had a holiday. I did my degree exam in the autumn. At that time, you could do it in the summer. I had got some trouble with my eyes, and as a result of which, I asked to be allowed to do the exam in the autumn rather than the summer. You could do it in both, and yes, at that time, you could do it. And it was a general degree. And I did a degree in the autumn that year. Now, why did I bring that part up?
Because I'm sure.
Oh, yes.
Because you got a chance then to get out, did you?
One thing I did have a chance because I was doing physics. You did practicals, and the practicals were in the afternoon. What I used to do was go into my Prior Street for dinner on some days, whenever the afternoon was. That was our church in Whitefriars Street. And I get my lunch there. Mm-hmm.
But this was one of the rules of the order to stay within the grounds, was that?
Yes, you weren't allowed to get home very often in those days.
For what reason? Or?
It was just that was the way it was.
You accepted it?
Oh, you automatically accepted it. That was, you were kept. It wasn't just the rule of the order. I think it was in general, it was the kind of way that students for the priesthood or for the order, for religious orders were treated in the same way in those days. They have much more freedom nowadays than we had then.
As soon as you were professed then, you were back in here and you were teaching.
Yeah, I was sent back here to teach.
No, it was boarding school in those days.
And, it was, yes.
What class were you? You were teaching secondary.
Oh, I was teaching secondary all the time, actually. And at every level. When I started here in 1958, certainly in 53, 54, there were only two streams in every class in the senior school. When I came back here towards the end of the 50s then, gradually the school increased. But at the same time, we had already devised a kind of a third stream. At that stage, you used to pass the intercert, and remember, a pass was required. You had to get past five subjects, which included Irish and maths. And Irish to get a cert, you had to pass five subjects, including Irish Mass. Now, you could get, if you got 30% in Irish and 40% in maths, or the other way around, 40% in Irish or 30% in and 30% in maths, you would could pass the exam. So we used to have a special class for some of these, and you kind of said Irish and maths. And
these were the subjects you were pushing.
These were the subjects we were pushing.
Because if you remember, this was before the Celtic Tiger. It was before we entered the common market.
It was a time,
you know, when I would imagine things were a lot. How different, just from a teaching aspect?
There's no difference really from a teaching aspect at the time. There was very little there's very little difference as far as I was concerned with teaching. I liked teaching, and I didn't matter whether I was a good group or a weak group. I liked teaching them both, and I spent a lot of time thinking about how I would teach various bits and pieces of the subjects. And anything I learnt at school or learnt at university is still there. Yep. Things that came in as new parts, these are the bits that even afterwards I had to look up each time I had to do them. You know what I mean? It was just that they weren't part of me the same way as, say, calculus was part of me from university and so on like that. I'd know if I could do calculus now with very little revision at this moment, you know? But because I learned it at university. But the other things, the new maths and things like that, some of the things that were put onto the course subsequently, there was no problem with doing them, but I found that every time I did them, I had to look it up again, whereas the other ones were there all the time.
Yeah, but on the curriculum, you had algebra and you had...
Yeah, you had arithmetic, algebra, geometry, you had three maths subjects. And there was one guy there, and I remember it was a young guy, one of the Swanton, I think it was Ian Swanton. And we used to have maths exams at Christmas, Easter, and summer in every class. And I know that from the time I had this guy from first year to sixth year, there were 6 years there, I would say that you could count on the fingers of one hand the times, the number of marks he lost. In other words, he was getting practically 100% all the time, all those years. You know? And he was very good.
I mean, that was obviously a huge genius in one side. But did you have people in the classroom who were, you know, difficult and had learning disabilities? And how did you cope with that?
Well, the point about it is, a lot of learning disabilities, there are people, I don't think we recognised a lot of learning disabilities in those days, in the sense that they'd be recognised now. I don't think people knew about them a lot. We knew they were weak. I know a guy now that was very poor at maths, and then there were some guys that you could drag through in maths. You could give them a lot of confidence in themselves by doing something which appeared difficult to them, but which was not that really that complicated. So you started off doing that kind of thing. They were weak. I remember one lad there. And I'm not saying it was that period. It might have been a bit later, but I just said, look. He, for some reason or other, he has absolutely no ability in maths, and there's no point in him continuing with it.
Yeah.
He was working above himself as it was.
I imagine, yes.
And we just said there was no. I said, look, there's no point. It's only life is difficult for him, and we didn't. And he's one of our priests now, which is the same guy. But as I say, I didn't, when I was teaching kids, I didn't regard I didn't have any knowledge, or that's not the word I'm looking for, but there was no appreciation of whether they had learning difficulties or not, as far as I was concerned. That's the only one that stands out for in the time I was teaching. You could always get them to, if the weaker guys, you could teach them to pass exams. The stronger guys, you could teach them mathematics.
Yeah. Well, you had, for a whole decade and a half, you had boarders here during your teaching time.
Yeah.
And as well as the day pupils coming in.
Yeah.
Did you find that time in your life when you were in charge of the boarders a great responsibility, much more than...
I don't think so. I don't think we looked at it that way. Probably there was a responsibility, all right. I know once some guys went missing or things like that, you got very worried about them and so on in that sense. But outside that, I think for the most part, boarders didn't cause us any trouble and we didn't cause them any trouble. Or, you know, not too much anyway. I know, for instance, one lad tells me that he came here in fifth year and it took him a year to figure out that nobody was out to get him. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And whatever school he'd been in before, he had but he came with that attitude. It took about a year before he realized that nobody was out actually to get him. So I think... And boarders always have their problems, mostly about food. There's always something wrong with food. It doesn't matter. They always talk about we'd love to get a priest dinner, you know, that thing. And I'll tell you what can be a problem with boarders is if you give them good food in the sense that you give them things like that don't come out of a tin. Like, what should I say?
Potatoes, or
other things. They don't like. There was a tendency not to like things that were cooked, that were normal food.
Yeah. Just didn't. It wasn't fast food enough that.
Sometimes it was probably the food was probably as good as it could be. I'm not saying now that it was better than that, but the point about it was that I found that they didn't like fresh food.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? What we would regard as fresh food as adults at the time, you know, and they that was basically their main complaint.
Yeah,
I would think, and I think that's true of all boarding schools.
Well, Terenure College itself was very proud of its, of its games and of its colours. You know, the Terenure colours and the uniform and all of that. There was a very strict regime here.
Yes, I suppose it was strict for the time. But I wouldn't think it was over strict in many cases. There were a few things now at times maybe that it was over strict, but in general it wasn't. I think most of the guys that were here would have good memories of the place. There may have been occasions when something went wrong and some kind of punishment was strictly given, but I don't think... I think most of the guys they remember their days here pretty well when they come back in.
I think you were the man responsible for waking up the students in the dormitories in the morning.
Okay, we were all had our turns of that. It depended on what. I can't remember the system, but I wasn't responsible for waking. I would have been responsible for waking in my turn them up in the morning. I cannot remember the system. You see, each there were three dormitories at the time. And there was a person in charge, and he slept beside the dormitory, each dormitory, and he was responsible for that. there were certain times when you were on the job and you would wake, I can't remember what the system was actually. You weren't, I wasn't responsible for getting them up in the morning all the time.
Yes.
I had my turn at it, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And it was, as far as I remember, you know what I mean? It's a long time ago. And it was, there was no problem, basically. The problem was, we brought them down to Mass. They got up and they went to Mass. And then when in the 60s, then after the Vatican Council, it became possible to say Mass in the evening, we stopped getting them up for Mass, and they came straight down to breakfast when they got up. And then what happened basically was there was always in my time for the boarders, when we had boarders, they always, every weekday anyway, can't remember Sundays. I think Sundays was also true, but there was always a period of study from 20 past 5 till 6, and then they went in for tea. I'd say that the idea basically was, it was a counting thing, where they had, we got them all still, or things like that. But what they did when the Mass came in, when it became possible that they could leave the study, we started at 20 to 6 Mass here, and we had it in the church for them. And anybody that wanted to go to Mass was let out of study and got the Mass, and then would be finished by 6. But the Mass got very popular here, as people started coming into it on the way home from work and things like that. It got quite, that's why we ran a 20 to 6 Mass for years here, until very recently, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And the same with the morning Mass then. The day, boy, we started at 8:45 Mass. We used to start school in those days, I think about 9:10. For some, don't ask me why 9:10, but 9:10 was it. So during Lent, we started saying, okay, if you want to go to Mass, we'll have a Mass at 8:45. Mm-hmm. And then people started coming in. So we had 8:45 Mass for years here, even after the boarders were gone, and a 20 to 6 Mass here. And that was, it was the boarders, it was for the use of the boarders that it started.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the families. Generally, there was a tradition that if a member of the family came, the brother, his brother and his other brother would come as well.
You got a number of these, yeah.
Did you find that students were coming to you here in turn, your college, when they were boarding from particular parts of the country in their...
You could get that. You could get that. I think. All right. There were some border. This could happen in borders, for borders. All right. Where I forget now, Castle Blaney's comes strictly to mind. I think there were a number of pupils that came to us from Castle Blaney at that time, because one or other had started coming and the others brought the others with them. That's just one where that sticks out in my mind, and I'm sure there were others, but that is one area. You did get, if you got one from a particular part, very often you got others coming as well from that particular part.
But it was predominantly Dublin students coming here.
The most boarders we ever had was about 120, and that might be pushing it a little bit, but it's fairly close. But usually you had somewhere around 100. Now, as we were able to take on more boarders when we started using rooms over here. The provincial at the time built this house over here, and he made small rooms in it, which were supposed to, he had some idea that he would bring some of the students, our clerical students from Gartmira, over to live here in the thing, and it never happened. And instead we were able to use these rooms for the 6 years and 5th year boarders. Mm-hmm. 6 year boarders usually, and consequently we had more room for borders at that stage. So they did get up at some stage to around the 120 mark.
Oh, why did the college decide to stop taking borders?
I would say that one, there was a lot of thought given to this, and some are very much against it and so on like that, against giving them up. But basically, we reached a stage where we had about 1,000 day boys and 100 borders, and all our energy was going into the 100 borders. And most of us said, look, we shouldn't. We've got to look after these day boys better than we are, because, all, as I say. And that was one of the factors, certainly, in it.
Yeah. You took on rugby teams yourself.
Yeah.
You brought them out for training and you brought them through the ropes. Did you take great pleasure in doing that?
When I came here first, I was very interested in sport, but I had no knowledge of rugby. I grew up beside Dalymount Park, and my main interest was soccer. And even still now, after all these years looking after rugby teams, if there's a good rugby match and a good soccer match on the television, I'd probably watch the soccer match, you know. But when I came over here, I was asked to take the under 14. I said, no, sure, don't mind about it. So I then... But I was still interested. I was interested in athletics. I was interested in soccer and so on. And I, as far as rugby was concerned, there were only the two competitions for schools, a senior cup and a junior cup, and everybody else had seconds and thirds and things like that. Or there was a man in Belvedere, Father Callahan, and he'd ring up and say, can you give me 15 fellas that can't play football? And he sent out the same. So it would be that kind of thing. But in point of fact, what happened was, I started after a while refereeing these second and third seniors when I got a bit of knowledge about the thing. And then by asking stupid questions, what should I have done and what did I do when such and such a thing happened, I was able to referee these matches. And Father Keenan was here at the time, and he became prior in 61. Now, I had an arrangement with him that I would referee the matches here if he travelled with the teams when they were playing away. that suited me down to the ground. So that's what I did, and I got to know more and more about rugby that way. And then this continued. In 1966 or 7, I think, they discovered, they made a second senior league. And suddenly I was in charge of a team that was going into these kind of things, and you had to start saying, well, what really does win matches and all this kind of stuff. And we won the league in 69, and we were in the final most years after for a number of years after that, but got beaten by Rock. Always had two teams in, and you usually ended up playing both of them, and when you'd beaten one, the other knew all all about you, and they very often beat us after that.
And did you see talent coming up through the rugby players? Did you see lads go on to play in for the country?
Strangely enough, I know some of the guys that played for the country. Now, I don't know nothing to them. You got people like Bren Sherry and Mick Hipwell. Now, they went back to the 50s, 58s and 61s and things like that. And I personally had nothing to do with them, but I knew they were good. And I was also a constant looker on at the past pupils playing on the other side of the church there, other side of the lake. But my own contribution basically was that after that period, I then decided that I was going to give those up, and I went down and I started training the under 13s, and I trained them for a number of years. Now, I got a number of past pupils out. Mick Carroll used to come out, for instance, on a Sunday morning, and we'd have a practice. that my the way I used to handle it was I used to have a, say mass for have a practice and say mass for them over in the oratory over there at I think 10:30, and then we would bring them out for a practice afterwards, and we got a few had a few exciting days. Sid Miller came down one day. And he came. He was to come after an international match, and there was a fire in his business at home. And he came down the following Sunday. So he's a couple of wonderful matches like that. So basically, then I was anxious to take the. I got interested in taking the senior team because we hadn't won the cup since 1958. And I said, "Give me a go, Daddy." So I then took the team, the senior team in 77 basically, before the 78 season, and we got to the of those things. We got to the final three finals and won two of them in 4 years. And we the 78 one we were red hot favourites to win, and we managed to lose. The next one, it, in my estimation, going in, we were about 50-50. We were playing Rock, and we won. And the third time, we went in, and we were now playing against Rock again, and we were as much, they were as much favourites as we had been the year we were favourites and lost, and we won this one. So everything goes back. And after that, I just took it for one more year. So I'd give it a go and see if you could win it three times. And we got as far as the... We drew Rock in the quarterfinal. Mm-hmm. And the only scores in the match, Rock scored a penalty from the touchline and the last kick of the first half. And we, with the last kick of the second half, just missed the ball going over there. So we were beaten 3-0 or something like that.
But it certainly must have been very exciting for you. But did you kind of put your eye on somebody that you said, oh no, this fella here now, he'll go on and he'll
it was it. Hard to know. Actually, none of those gang actually played for Ireland subsequently. We had one lad here, and he was David Webb. He was captain of one of the teams. He was captain. He had got three medals out of it, actually, two junior medals and a senior medal. And I remember he was number 13, and I remember going down to Newbridge to play them. And in even those days, even in friendly matches, we weren't allowed to bring on subs. Even in friendly matches. So I knew he was coming. So we played the first half with 14 men. It was nil all at half time. And we, in the second, Rall Father, I forget what his name was, started giving his team talk at half time to this gang in Newbridge. They would have been all new people at that stage, you know. And then suddenly this car drives up and this guy gets out, togged out. And they said, look at the size of the fella they're bringing on. And he says his talk went for nothing. Now, Dave, that day, he won three, maybe he won two junior medals and a senior medal. And he played for Ireland. And he was the smallest guy on the field. 5 years later, you know?
Yeah. But but you would see that probably at a very young age. And
well, some guys, everybody grows at different rates. Yeah. And sometimes they grow very early and they're as big as at the under-13s as they're going to be, at 13 as they're ever going to be. They'll fill out okay, but they're as tall and the rest of them. Whereas some guys just stay small, and suddenly they shoot up in sixth year or somewhere like that.
But going back again now to your own life here, did you, in all that length of time, did you find yourself becoming institutionalized? You know, that this was your home now.
Well, I suppose... you did, I suppose, become institutionalized to a large extent. You could not, after all, it is an institution. So it's hard not to become institutionalized to a degree. I suppose, yes, that was true, but that didn't matter. I had a reputation for not going out very much. I've made up for that since, by the way.
Was there a reason for that at the time?
No, I just... the only time I went out, I was on a number of sports committees, and I used to go along. Well, first of all, we weren't allowed to drive cars when I arrived here first. And then we were allowed... The first car arrived around sometime in the mid-60s. And it was very precious. We were all waiting for the first one to damage it. And as it happened, the prior and the sub-prior were out in the car one day. And they stopped at a traffic lights, and somebody crashed into the back of them. Well, that was their story, as we said. So everybody heaved a huge sigh of relief. But then as a result of that, there were an awful lot of guys around here that wanted to learn to drive. So if you wanted a lift anywhere, there was plenty of them there, only too willing to do take you somewhere. And I never caught up on that. I never drove as a result.
Yeah. You're the oldest member here in the college, are you?
I'm not the oldest member here in the college. Father Ryan and Father Flanagan. Now, they have not been here for quite a while. They did their theology in Rome, and they came back here to Ireland in 1954, I think. And Father Flanagan was here for 3 or 4 years, and Father Ryan was here for 6 or 7 years and taught in the junior school and things like that. But after that, they disappeared. I'm the only one left of the gang that are, if you like, career teachers.
Yeah.
You know, and it won't happen again, probably, that'll be anybody else like me.
I wouldn't think so, because your time is indeed a record in being a Carmelite here in the college and teaching for that length of time.
Well, there was Father Grace also, Father McCuig, they were always here in the college, Father Grace, Father McCuig.
Did you all get on?
Oh yeah, well, but you get on as well as you can with it. It's part religious life is about putting up with one another ultimately, and we got on all right. Occasionally we had our differences, as you do when people are living close together, but we got on pretty well practically all the time. You know, it's part of our vocation to, if you come into a religious scene, it's part of the scene that you have to try and get on with one another.
And were you prior at any stage?
No.
Did you decide?
No, I did more. I was not interested. Not before, from the point of view. I don't want to give a reason why I wasn't interested, but it wasn't from the point of view that I didn't want to accept authority. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the reason. I had my own reasons for it.
Mm-hmm. And did you find that with all the, you know, that a lot of your colleagues now would have passed on at this stage?
There's a lot of people have died, don't you?
Yeah.
If that's what you mean. There's a lot of the people that I grew up with and were very fine people, and they've died over that period. I grew up to Glasnevin now, and there are two gravestones where we're buried in a common grave up there. And the names of the guys are there. And on the two, they're now full. And I don't know, there must be 30 or so on each, you know, at least. And I go up there, and the only ones I don't, after the first, there's only about four, the first four that I didn't know. Now, okay, there are other graves. I'm just talking about these particular ones that started sometime in the 40s or something like that. And they're full now. And we've gone into a new part.
Imagine, yes.
And every one of those, I knew every one except about four of them.
So any one of those men that's, you know, that was an exceptional, is a hard question now to ask, but, you know, could you pick out someone who was extra special in your eyes?
I don't know. One of the guys that was great company. There was a Father Wright, I don't know whether you met him yourself at any stage, but he weighed about 20 stone, but was built absolutely in proportion.
Yes.
When they came to bury him, they couldn't believe, they had to get a casket for him. They couldn't believe he was so wide.
Yes.
And they had to get a casket to put him in. But he was, apart from being a good religious, he could keep you entertained for hours at a time.
Where did he come from?
He came from, what's the name of the place? Ballytor. And he had all his stories, and all his metaphors were agricultural. But he could keep you amused for hours. You just said yes and no at all the right times. And he would keep on, the stories would pour out of him. That's okay. Maybe there were other ones that could go before him, but he's one we were all very fond of. You know.
As
a huge man.
And if you can imagine, the college here is a place of, in your lifetime here, you've gone through all the changes.
Yes.
Changes in the religious life as well as changes in the teaching.
Yeah.
So, you've been on both sides of the fence. In your own opinion, how do you find... In the teaching first, we'll take the teaching. You know, the corporal punishment is now finished, obviously, for many years, and the curriculum has changed.
One of the things at the moment, we have six people, I think, teaching in the school. I think it's six. One, three, and one, four. It's five or six anyway. Five, maybe it's six. But at any rate, we have those. Now, they're all of an age. They're all, actually, I think there's two of them over 40 and the rest are approaching 40 past. So, now, and they're the ones that are teaching in the school, and consequently, they're all of the same kind of mindset. Whereas in my time there were people of all ages teaching and all the rest of it. Whereas now this, and I think they are doing, because they're all... modern and have the same type of mindset, I think they're doing a very good job here as far as...
And did you not think the fact that when you were teaching that you had the man that was in his 30s and 40s and the man that was in his 50s?
I know, it's a different... I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is that it's we got on very well and we taught very well. And some of us were very good teachers. And,
but some of you were the old school and some of you were probably the new school.
Yes, it's I don't know when it started. I think I taught here till about 1990, at which stage I got some trouble. I was getting headaches at night, and for quite a while nobody could figure out why I was getting these headaches, and they were preventing me from preparing class and things like that. They were that type, and they were very bad. And at that stage then, I stopped teaching, and eventually they found out that it was a blood pressure problem. And I had to more or less find out myself. From the time we'd boarders, we got rid of boarders in 1972. From the time we'd boarders, there was a nurse that used to gather, and she was still here. So I got into the habit of, I discovered that she had a monitor for taking blood pressure. And I got arranged with her that after the news, every night I would go in and she'd take my blood pressure. And it showed up. It wasn't showing up at the times it was being taken by the other doctors. It wasn't showing up, and it was only showing up at night time. So at that stage then, I discovered that I was getting agitated too easily. I was getting hassled too easily. And for my own sake and the rest, let's get out of this. And I then looked for the job that had been run by Father Clark as assistant to the bursar here in the college. And I got in there and started there in 91, and Father McCuig was the man in charge, and I was now the assistant for the next 10 years or 11 years or so. And in that time,
I suppose the administration work suited you.
No, I did. Oh yeah, I took it. I was like a duck to water. No problem. But what I was trying to say, I computerized.
Oh, because your mathematical
the whole
knowledge and the way you
I computerized the whole area. Up there and so on. So that was my contribution. And in 2002, I got very sick. And I'd say it was stress. And it was stress. And I got heart problems, and I ended up in hospital with double pneumonia, and shouldn't have got out alive, basically. But I did, and lost a couple of stone. And then it came back out. So now I'm not asked to do too much that period. And that was the end of my teaching period. Now, in that time then, these new group have come in, and they've taken the place. All of us that were there, Father Grace was older than I was, Father McCuig was older than I was. They were out of teaching at this stage and so on. So this group have gradually taken over the place. And it's been really there since sometime in the mid-90s or so, or beginning with the 90s and building up to where it is now, you know. And I think that's where, as I say, they're a group that are of an age, have the same kind of mindset, and they know what they're...
But that was my question. Do you think that new group that has come in are better than what you were?
No, I'm not sure they're better. I don't think that's the word you'd use. They are up to date with the times, more as we were up to date with our times.
Mm-hmm. But the format of your teaching, could you honestly say that was a good way of delivering the message or the knowledge or the...
It was, from my point of view, I had no great problem saying yes to that question. I never taught mathematics only. Every now and again, we just abandoned it and had a chat about all sorts of things, religion and otherwise, you know?
Yeah.
But so that there was that. One of the problems that we got from the point of view that still, I think it's not just me and it's not just Terry Muir, but after Vatican Council, it became fashionable that we were told that we had to teach catechetics. Now, up to that stage, we'd been teaching theology, and we were very good at teaching theology, and we'd hadn't a clue about catechetics and all this stuff about relationships and so on, and we didn't know whether we were teaching humanism or what we were doing, but we weren't trained for it. And I think we lost a generation there when that came in. I'm not saying they wouldn't be lost anyway, but I think we lost a generation there while they changed over to this new way of looking at things.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether it's right or wrong even still. I know now when people go to the novitiate, you know, a lot of the things we knew, an awful lot of from the catechism and the books, remember the Christian doctrine books we used to imbibe in those days, we knew a lot about our faith, even as youngsters, and because it was kind of drilled into us and so on like that with the catechism answers and so on. Whereas now they have to send, a guy joining has to go down and learn that kind of thing, which we almost had from the beginning, you know?
Yeah, but the atmosphere in a classroom has changed dramatically as well. The student is no longer under this kind of position where it's worried about whether it's going to get a slap or not.
There are other ways that it can be worse than a slap. You know,
but so do you think that maybe because that has stopped, that the you don't have the same discipline in the classroom.
No, I think some of them, they have discipline, all right. There are ways that they can deal with that pretty easily.
Psychological ways.
There are other ways. I think that there's a lot of discipline still here in the school. And it isn't, as I say, this isn't corporal punishment written like that, but you adapt to the new situation.
Yeah, so it's punishment another way.
It is, well, it's punishment another way, yes, or it's you're interviewed and you can, and some people are very good at saying, putting it to people. After all, it's hard to know. I see on the paper this morning, I don't know whether you're a soccer follower or not, but a young Keane there, the guy on Tottenham, plays for Robbie Keane, that plays for Tottenham.
Yeah.
The last day he came off the field, he was taken off and he flung his thing at the general direction of the rest, and he's been fined, what is it, £125,000. You know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I mean to say, there are ways of, you get when one goes out, it might take you time, but you put something in its place.
Did you like teaching?
Yes, loved it.
Did you like boys?
Yes, I could honestly say that I could count easily on the fingers of one hand the number of kids that I actually disliked.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is, I've always said that.
And you went through quite a few. Yeah.
Well, I went through a lot of kids because I, as I say, I like teaching maths and I did an awful lot of it.
Yeah.
As I say, I don't know how much information I've given you now about that over a period. I've given you information about myself, about my own attitudes, and about the attitudes of the people I worked with, and so on. And I know the kind of system. At the moment, as I say, there's a new group in there, and they've moved with the times, and they have their own way of doing things, and so on. And you can, as I say, you were talking about corporal punishment and all the rest of it. There are worse things than corporal punishment.
And the other question was religious life. The restrictions on the order wouldn't be as severe.
You have more freedom. That is true. Most of the guys here now, they're dedicated in their work. But if they want to get away, get into a car and go home, well, some of them live in Dublin. A few of them live in the district, actually, close by. And their parents are still there. But it's within certain limits.
Do you feel kind of sad that that you didn't have those benefits?
No, not really. Not really.
Really?
Not
yeah.
really. I've enjoyed my time here. I wouldn't have stayed here if I didn't enjoy it. And I could have got out of it at any time. And I enjoyed my time here. And I never wanted to be anywhere else.
What about the uniform? That's gone.
The uniform is here still. Oh,
your own.
No, in class they wear the habits. They still wear the habits in class. They will come out and run around the place, or they may be dressed like me and all the rest of it. But in class, they wear the habits still.
Mm-hmm.
And it's when I was in class, I always wore them.
And the Carmelite Parade, we're facing the 150th anniversary here of the college in Terenure. How many Carmelites here now in the college?
There are, in the community at the moment, as far as I know, there are 11. There are 11, maybe 12. I think there are 11 of us.
And is that a far cry from what it used to be?
Well, when I came here first, there were about 24 of us.
Yeah.
And there were practically no lay teachers at the time.
What do you see the role for Carmelites in the future?
For Carmelites in the future, it depends. First of all, at the moment we're trying to figure that out, in a sense that we are going through a what do you call it, an examination of our what we're doing in the province and what we should be doing and all the rest of it. And certainly in the future, for instance, with the numbers going down, we still have a very small trickle of vocations coming in. But despite that, you won't be able to keep doing some of the things that you've been doing for years. And there's a lot of people now working who would, in 30 years ago, would no longer be working in the jobs they're in. And you could actually be possibly eventually accused of being unjust to these people by allowing them to do this, even though they want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
There's some of them in the 70s and things like that. And
did you ever see in your lifetime a time when maybe the laity will take over the college?
Oh, there is a possibility that the laity will take over the college in the sense that it I think there'll always be a Carmelite connection. If it reaches the stage where there's going to be, say, a lay principal, there will be the management will have at least four Carmelites on it. Now, what's going on, and whether there's any Carmelite working in the school at the same time, I don't know. There might be somebody in here that is kind of responsible for chaplaincy or something like that, even though the chaplaincy is not just a Carmelite thing at the moment. It's some of the teachers are involved in it and so on.
They have a say.
They have a say, yeah. Well, they're a big say. But it's some of them are very good. But I suppose like every school, as the numbers go down, you're faced with the possibility of this kind of thing happening.
Yeah.
And it'll probably happen here too. But the thing you want to try and, there's a Carmelite ethos that we would like to have. Now, it's hard to pin down what that means. It's hard to pin down what that means. But one of the good things about it is this, that we have a junior school, which is a private school. It's a small school. And you can do, because it's not a state school, they can do what they darn well like for most of the time. Okay, they're supposed to have it in a certain number of days in the year and things like that. But you can run it to a large extent the way you like to do it. And they are imbibed with a lot of stuff in religion, told about the stories of Carmelites, told about all sorts of things like that. And when they pass up through it, they're a very important part of the school, because when they go into first year, they usually get about 16 or 70 or maybe more pupils coming in. And these guys are there and they know the traditions of the place and all the rest of it. And they can help the others coming in to understand how they behave or what the stories are and so on like that. So we always feel that the junior school is very, even though it's a very important part of the place for that reason.
Yeah.
I remember one year there, some years back when I was there, and I don't know what's happening at the moment, but I remember one year we had a class which everybody was new in it in first year. You know, there was none of them were from the junior school. And that class was completely different from every other class in the school. And showed it. I can't say that why, but it was
different.
Completely different. You know?
The Carmelites, where did they originate from?
That's a good story. First of all, most orders have come into existence for some purpose, like education or teaching or nursing or medical reasons or whatever it might be. But we happen to be there in the 1200s, 1100s, late 1100s, 1200s. There was a group of people living on Mount Carmel, and they were hermits. So the basic thing was that they there was a guy called Albert of Jerusalem, who was the Archbishop or Patriarch of Jerusalem, who was never in Jerusalem because that was held by the Moors at the time. But this this group of hermits asked him for a rule of life. Now they must have known, he must have known what they were doing already, because obviously they were doing, they had some kind of rule of life and so on. But he put it on paper in a letter, and what they were to do, and they were to come together and assemble for Mass each day and so on, and spend a lot of their time in their rooms meditating in the law of the Lord and so on. And then they got chased out of Palestine, and they came to Europe. And this was the time when the mendicant orders were starting up, the Franciscans, Dominicans, and so on. There were itinerant preachers and so on like that. And the Carmelites joined in that kind of, instead of hermits, they started working in that kind of area. So they're a mendicant order. Mendicant usually means beggar. So you may get, you're depending on people.
People's alms.
People's alms and so on like that.
And who invited the Carmelites into Ireland?
I don't know. I know that they were here in the 1200s, in the early 1200s.
As far back as that.
And there are quite a number of places over in Ireland where there were ancient monasteries and things like that. And then, of course, with the dissolution of the monasteries, they went down, according to our historian, it went down to a stage where there was only one Carmelite in Ireland. He must have been a great man. It didn't last, stay that way for long.
Yeah.
And we have traditional houses that we're in at the moment. We have the three K's, we call them, Kinsale, Knocktopher, and Kinsale, Knocktopher. What's the other one?
Somewhere in the Midlands, isn't there?
We have a moat in the Midlands. Yes. Kinsale, there were three K's, Kinsale, Knocktopher, and Kildare.
Kildare, yeah.
We have a friary's there. And
how did the Carmelites wind up here in Turin, Europe?
They came here in, they bought this house in about 1856. And they lived, according to a plumber that does the plumbing here, his father told them that they stayed in the house he was brought up in, which is down the road, for a couple of years before they actually moved into the college.
Whereabouts was that house?
It's on the Temple Oak Road. It's, I think, 101 or 102 or something like that. It's on the Temple Oak Road. It's a double house. And I asked him, was there any sign that it had ever been a single house? No, he said it was a semi-detached house. But they came here then in 18... they came here some probably about 2 years, and they opened the school then in the year 1860, the 11th of January. Now, interestingly enough, at the same time, the Holy Ghosts, who were known as the French Order, had come to Ireland at that time, and they stayed in Whitefriar Street, and they wanted to set up a school. And they didn't want to be in competition with us, because they were very friendly with us. So they put it as far away as possible out in Black Rock. And it's called a French school for quite a while, but it is Black Rock College. So there's a connection. We both have the same centenary, and they both have the same 150 years, so we're both at the same time.
Well, that's very interesting. And it's and a lot of rivalry between the two of you when it comes
well,
to
there,
the
Well, there is now. Let me say, the original idea was that we were sufficiently far apart that we wouldn't be interfered with.
So it's interesting to see how both orders still survive in such a strong capacity within the college itself.
Yeah.
But how do you find finally the college Turin Europe? It hasn't changed since that 150 year that they arrived.
It hasn't changed.
Well, the only thing that has, the main building hasn't changed. The church was rebuilt.
Yeah.
And the buildings out the back have been, but the house itself is very much the same.
The house, this is the oldest part of the house at this time. And the first part that was built on was the one that continues on from here. When you go out the door, when you pass what's obviously the old house, you'll see the next connection was the bit. And it was built as for dormitories, and they had a stage below it and all the rest of it, where they ran plays of times.
Oh, yes, that reminds me, you were involved in plays, which I'll talk to you about in a sec. But the actual walls around the college, were they remained the same, don't they? Did it expand out?
We never...
Did you purchase land?
No, we had the land that we always had. And it went with it. There has been no change in that over the years. It's the same. Yeah.
And before I forget of it, finally, talk to me a little bit about your time being involved with plays here in the school.
Well, I was General Dog's buddy. There was a Father Hannigan here. He was a bit of a genius. Because he was a genius at casting. We used to have boys used to play with girls' parts and so on like this and in those days. And he was a genius at casting, but he was also, to my mind, probably the best producer of the school plays we ever had, because he could do everything. He could paint scenery. He could he could organize lights. He could teach the kids, produce the kids, and all the rest of it. He was very good. And I came in. I was just helped out at a kind of General Dog's body, looked after lights. He spent half my life there at the middle of the night sometimes, and he'd say, the lights were all up on a balcony behind the stage. You'd set the lights for something or other, and he'd say, come down and have a look at that. And I'd say, now, would you ever go back up? Another bit. So you spent a lot of time doing that kind of thing.
And this was Father Hand, is it?
Father Hannigan.
Hannigan.
Father Seamus O'Hannigan. One of the of course, the outstanding actor we've produced is Donald McCann.
Oh, yes. Yes. And he started his career here.
Oh, he did, yeah. I remember him playing Malvolio in Twelfth Night here. He wanted to play, he was very anxious to play Hamlet, but he actually played Polonius, which was really his part, and Hamlet wasn't his part. But I remember there at times with Malvolio, and if you were standing beside him, he had a wonderful
persona.
Act. And very clear. But if you were down in the hall, his accent, the accents he put on, covered up in other words, what I'm trying to say is, he had to learn at that stage. If I want to imitate a Dublin accent, as I've done on occasion, and I'm doing it to a large crowd, you have to exaggerate the Dublin accent, otherwise they don't pick it up. You know, I remember telling a story in a sermon one time about the time when coming back in a bus the day of the Annunciation. Not the Annunciation, but the day that the 1st of November was 1950, when they declared the dogma of the Assumption.
Oh, yeah.
And I was on a bus that evening. We were given a free day. That was one of the days we got free. I was on a bus, and there was this man, and he had a grey suit. He was obviously a non-Catholic clergyman, because in those days everybody wore grey, and all the other rest of us wore black. We were very easy to distinguish. And there were two women on the bus, and they were kind of looking at this. And they said, you know, eventually, when they came to get up, they went up and stood in front of him, and they said to him, assumed body and soul into heaven. That shook you.
Well,
now, if you overdo that,
Yes.
You've got to, if you're saying that in a public, as I told the story one time in Lourdes when I was preaching out there, and you have to deliberately make sure that they hear what you're saying. So it's not, you can't say it in a complete Dublin accent, even though you, it sounds to them like a Dublin accent when it hits them, you know, that type of thing. Well, it's a trick.
It is, yes.
And it's a way of projecting through the accent. And Donal McCann at that time hadn't reached that stage where he was able to project his voice through the accent he'd adopted.
Yes.
You know, if you were beside him or near him on the stage, no problem. But if you were further down, it didn't come across as well.
You would detect, yeah. But I can certainly detect your own accent is a Dublin accent.
Oh, yeah.
And how would you suggest, is your Dublin, is it North Dublin, South Dublin, East Dublin?
No, it is a Dublin accent that has developed over the years, basically, that everyone, an awful lot of us use now. And it's the only, I don't hear my accent as a Dublin accent very much, but when I hear it on a record, I hear the Dublin accent in it.
Oh, it comes true, yes.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I have been away at many places now, and people say when I'm talking to them, say Belgians or some people like that, they say you're easier to understand than some of the English people. Now, the English people have very strong accents. At times, an awful lot, and with so many different accents in England. But the one that I have, and that a lot of people like me have and have adopted in Ireland, is a kind of neutral kind of accent. The words come clearly through it.
They do indeed. Father John Madden, it is a pleasure today sitting down and talking to you.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what I've let myself in for.